Thanks for joining us. It's another episode of Sacktown Talks. This week, I am pleased to introduce Lindsay Birch.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
You know, I'm well. I'm kind of, I'm just really happy that we were able to connect and kind of get you in here. We met a little over 2 months ago when I was just getting this started, right?
Well, yeah, I remember talking with you about it. We met through Young Democrats.
Right.
And at that time you had your jiu-jitsu podcast and you were just starting this one. So it's cool to now see that how much it's already grown in that time and be a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to the Young Dems. Stay righteous.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of had you in the back of my mind. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to have somebody, in the theater world come on. And then, frankly, I saw the article in the Bee. About the
Sophia and the new home of B Street and all that stuff.
Yeah. So I started poking around the website and I was like, oh my God, that's Lindsay.
Yep. That's me. Yeah. I'm currently the artistic producer and have the great joy and challenge of being the move manager at B Street. So I'm managing the whole move to the new facility, which you read the article about in the Bee. And we're really excited. We get occupancy in about 7 weeks with an opening on February 2nd of next year. So it's very fast approaching. And I think that's why there's now so much, there's always been buzz around it, but so much more buzz and press around what the facility means to the community.
Right, right. What a great time to be a Sacramentan.
It's amazing.
Right.
And I'm not from Sacramento, and so, but this is, June will mark 5 years here for me. And so it's been amazing to, in the short amount of time that I've been here, watch the city really grow and flourish and add cultural destinations such as the Sophia, but also, the Wall Project, the murals and everything that's happening in the city. And I mean, obviously the arena, there's so much happening.
Yeah. And the sense of pride that's sort of, I think, starting to take over the city as well. I've been here for about 7 years now, and kind of a little bit about what you talked about, just sort of seeing it change in kind of a short period of time. Right. I moved over here 'cause I wanted to work in the legislature. And so I was really excited to work in the legislature, but everything else about settling into Sacramento was kind of reluctant.
Yes.
You know, especially for myself, I grew up surfing, and so there's not anywhere to really surf up here.
Yeah, no, this is not surf country.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of had to find other interests to pursue, and slowly but surely, Sacramento just sort of grew on me. You know.
Yeah, I've been in theater, my whole life essentially, and I always knew I wanted to have a career in theater, or at least, pursue a career in theater. And so I thought that would land me, I'm from the East Coast, so I thought that would land me in New York, Chicago, DC, Boston. And so Sacramento was not even on my radar. The only West Coast thing remotely on my radar was LA. So to end up here and to now have it be both my personal and artistic home has been just a great surprise,
Yeah. And so what was that like? Where were you immediately prior to Sacramento?
I was in North Carolina. I'm from Charlotte, and I went to school at Elon University. And I got hired right out of Elon to work as the directing intern at B Street. B Street has a professional intern program that helps young artists bridge the gap between their academic and their professional careers, because as I'm sure you're aware, it's very hard to kind of find your way as an artist. There's not a certain set career path. And so the internship, which is paid and provides housing, really helps young artists.
Cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know we had that here.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? So they recruit people from all over the country. I got recruited at a national theater conference, and they pay you and they provide you housing. So just kind of came out here with the commitment of doing the internship for an 8-month contract, and now it's 5 years later. So
wow.
That's kind of that story.
Yeah, that's sort of akin to the fellowship that they have going on over at the state capitol.
Oh yeah, it's a year long, or how long?
Yeah, so over at the state capitol they have a Senate and Assembly fellowships, as well as executive branch fellowship. and it's kind of exactly what you described.
Is that what Matt Canty did? He was talking about some sort of fellowship or something, because he was not in politics and then he got involved. And so
I'm not sure if he's he probably is. Yeah. If he said he did a fellowship, that's the one.
That's the one. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's so interesting to me, sort of tracking like the different things that bring people to Sacramento, right?
Right.
So the way the fellowship in the building works is it's for folks who kind of have their college degree and want to get involved. It's typically aimed at like younger folks, like right out of college, but there are like mid-career professionals looking to like make a switch sometimes, you know?
Right.
And it's like 11 months, and they provide you a stipend, and they put you in either an executive branch office or in a legislative branch office. And then some people stay and some people go, right? But you kind of have this cohort that you can track. And
right.
And you stayed.
Exactly. Yeah, it's strange. You know, now I've seen my intern company and almost four others after that. And to see, you know, who from each group stays in Sacramento or even stays in touch with the theater and comes back and really feels like Sacramento and B Street are a home for them. But, you know, I think that I would venture to say most people who leave a program like the one they offer at B Street, they know how challenging a career in theater is going to be, and they know if they're ready for that.
Yeah.
And that's so important, because college is such an incubator. You know, you don't really know what the field is like and what, how much you're really going to have to hustle to get your art seen and get your work out there. So
is there a sense that there's, you know, you talked about this just a second ago, but I kind of wanted to touch on this again, that there's no sort of like, game plan for being a professional artist, in the sense that there is for, you know, if you want to be a doctor, you
ace
your classes,
yeah.
You go to medical school, and then you come out the other end, and it's like, boom, you're a doctor. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think about doctors, lawyers, teachers, you know, I mean, just the typical accountants, you know, you go to school, you take the exams, you get your certification, and then you do it, right? You go work for a firm or a practice, or you start your own or what have you. But when you want to have a career as a professional artist, there is no specified path. You know, some people do go the graduate school route, but that can be very expensive, and it doesn't guarantee you're going to get work, you know, and you might have student loans that you need to pay back, and then you're trying to make it as an actor, but you're waiting tables even though you have your master's degree. So it's kind of yeah, and it's kind of a crapshoot, honestly. You know, you just don't know. And I think, and this kind of segues into some of the questions that, you know, I know we were going to talk about today, is that I think it's actually easier for aspiring actors, because there's a little bit more of a career path. You join Actors Equity, which is the professional actors union in the United States. You get an agent. You know, you get your agent to, or your manager to send you on auditions, and you go on those auditions and you book those auditions, and you hope that the people you meet when you book something get you something else, right? But when you're an aspiring director, especially, you know, a young director like myself, there's essentially nothing for you. I came out of college, like, had no idea how to have a career as a director. Other than, try to assist directors you admire. Just say, can I be your assistant? Can I be in the room? So what B Street offered me was really invaluable, which was 8 months mentorship with the artistic director, Buck Busfield, at B Street. I got to be with him in every rehearsal and in his office whenever he was doing casting and play selection. And then he gave me 4 opportunities to direct when I was an intern. And so that took those academic credits off my resume, which, you know, everybody's like, oh, you directed in college, whatever. and put professional experience on my resume when I was 22, which basically nobody gets, because nobody knows how to be a director when, you know, you're 22, you know?
Yeah. That seemed, as I prepared for this and I thought about it, it seemed so fraught to me, like, who's going to let you just come in and direct? like, yeah. Oh, well, I'll get out of the chair, and why don't you just take a seat, and why don't you just start calling the shots? Like,
exactly.
How do you get your foot in the door?
It's so, I mean, even when you assist for amazing directors, you, in which I've done a lot of assisting, and it's really, I've learned so much. It's been invaluable. The artist I've met in the room, the things that I've learned, there's no substitute for doing as an artist. You know, as an actor, there's no substitute for acting. As a director, there's no substitute for directing. You know, you have to get your feet wet actually doing it, and that's what's so hard to get, that opportunity.
Right.
And to my, what I've been given, which is such an incredible gift, is the opportunity to direct professional actors at B Street, because they make your directing better, and they challenge you, and they ask you questions, and they help you learn how to be a better director.
This internship program that they have, Elon, it's called?
Elon University is where I went to school. It's a small...
No, I meant the internship program with B Street.
Oh, it's just called the B Street internship.
Is that common? Do other theaters do that, or is that...
B Street's, I would say, is rare. I think a lot of theaters have postgraduate internships. A lot of them are not paid or don't provide housing. And B Street is probably only one of 4 to 5 directing internships in the whole country.
Oh, wow.
And
so that's what landed your application.
Right.
Got it.
Because there's a lot of internships, like casting internships, where you're, you know, sorting headshots and things like that. But that's really not...
That's like an internship.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I mean, mine was an internship. I mean, it's the B Street internship. I can't soft sell it. It's grueling, and you work really long hours, and you really learn if you want to do this. But the artistic benefit that you get from it, I think, far outweighs any of the challenges of cleaning the theater or painting the set at 11 o'clock at night. You know, all those things that you just have to do. To be in the room with professional artists and to get those opportunities right out of school, like, basically nobody gets that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then kind of thinking about how the whole thing is going to look as a totality, right?
Right. It's totally, I mean, the art's basically like any other career path, but it's totally about the long game, you know? It's, and I think that can be really hard for young artists coming out of school, you know, myself included. Just, you want to see, you just paid for a degree, and you worked so hard for your degree, and you want to see direct results from the work that you did, but that's just not how it works. You know, you have to pay your dues, and you have to learn from those who have come before you. And then your time does come. So,
right. Kind of force yourself to wonder, how long must I pay these dues? Right?
yeah. But I mean, I'm one of the lucky ones. I mean, I'm still paying dues in a lot of ways, but I have opportunities that people who have been directing for 10 years more than me would kill to have, which is incredible. And a huge testament to B Street and their investment, Buck's investment in young artists.
That's really cool. Can you sort of take us through your career so far in acting and directing? I know that you would produce some plays in India.
Yes, yeah, so it's sort of, yeah. So my career as a director, I'll just give the background a little bit. I started, so I've been directing plays since I was 12 years old. And which just sounds ridiculous. I directed my first play in middle school, and I've been directing plays since then. And I had this when I was like, the theater method of getting into college is very ridiculous and sort of fraught. You have to audition. In addition to your application and your essays and your transcripts and all that, you have to go on auditions and perform, and you travel all over the country. And the fact that like 17-year-old kids are expected to do it and also graduate from high school is a little bit ridiculous. But anyway, so I knew that I wanted to go into a program that, because even though I wanted to be a director, go into a program that still had acting training, because I didn't feel like I knew enough about what actors went through or how to communicate with them. So I went to Elon's BFA acting program, which requires the actors to take directing, play analysis, technical theater, theater history. So it's an acting program, but it also has a more diverse array of courses that kind of give you a more full arts education instead of just, and it's a liberal arts school, so you still take all your regular classes. But I still knew I wanted to be a director, and so that was all that I applied for when I was getting out of college, was just all directing programs, internships, fellowships, what have you. And I landed at B Street, which was obviously, like I said, not what I expected, but amazing. And then at B Street, in my internship, I actually directed the tour and then on all three professional stages, which no intern before me or since has ever done. So that was incredible, and I learned so much. It was trial by fire, but it was amazing. And I had, what saved me was I had great actors and a great institution behind me. You know, it wasn't just like, here's some money, go do a show somewhere. You know, I had all this support. And that, those opportunities is really what kind of like catapulted my career and put it on a fast track. You know, since then I've directed around the country. My focus is new and contemporary plays. You know, I've directed at theaters around the country, in the Bay, assisted in the Bay Area, you know, done some stuff in New York. And then I was an artist in residence in India, in Mumbai, for a world premiere production of a musical about the life of Gandhi, which is inspiring a production that I'm writing and directing for B Street's inaugural family series season, in the Sofia.
Got it.
So, I mean, that's kind of the long and short of it. And there's, obviously, there's still many things that I hope to do and accomplish, but B Street is a contemporary and new works company, and one of my favorite things is being, you know, in the room with living
players. What does that mean, new works?
New works, oh, so yeah, I guess I should explain that. So a new work is...
Like you're not going to be going over Phantom of the Opera.
Right, exactly. So a new work, I guess new work and world premiere can kind of be interchangeable, but a world premiere would be a play that's never been fully produced before. It might have had some readings or some workshops where people got together and worked on it, but it's a play that's never before been produced in front of a live audience. And that's primarily what I do. So I work with living playwrights. You know, I'm not working with Tennessee Williams or Edward Albee or whatever. And I work with living playwrights in the room.
Are they're in the room when you're...
Yeah.
Does that lead to some...
It depends on who it is, honestly.
Right, like you're, so like if you have a certain vision for how you want it to look, how you maybe even throw in an ad lib or something like that. Is there some potential for butting of heads there? Because
there is, you know, it depends. I just directed a new play at Sacramento.
Tell
Theater.
Me the worst playwright you've worked with. I'm just kidding.
I just directed a new play at Sacramento Theater Company. Okay. Well, I can say, well, I wouldn't want them to listen to this. I would never say the name. But I think the biggest thing, I will say it's all about the relationship. I just did a new play at Sacramento Theater Company in which I have a long-term relationship with the playwright. He and I have worked on the play together for 2 years. And that's a short amount of time compared. Some people work on plays together for 7, 8, 9, 10 years.
That long.
Yeah. And he and I had a great relationship, and we all take each other's advice. And, you know, I would say we... you know, maybe had one or two moments in the room that weren't even butting heads. It was just like, hey, let me do my thing. But I think that the hardest, one of the hardest things about being a theater artist and in general and the playwright-director relationship and also playwright-director-actor relationship is that everybody has to have their process, right? The actors have to have their process with their roles. The director has to have their process with the staging and the development. And the playwright has to have their process. And when people don't give everyone the space to do that, that's when people butt heads, you know? It's like if the playwright says on the first day, oh, you can't let the actor do it like that to the director. It's like, well, it's the first day. They're still learning that character. Or it's like, oh, you shouldn't have staged it like that. Well, this is my first draft, you know, let me have my first draft, just like you had your first draft of the play. And that goes for everybody. It's all about letting, you know, knowing when to give a note and knowing when to say something. And it's hard to know because that involves some trust, right? That people are going to get there, you know, right. Get to where you want them to go. And that's a large job of the director, is to kind of coordinate all those minds to be one collective mind, to feel like everything's coming together at the right time.
Do you ever think it would be easier to just do Tennessee Williams plays where he's not in the room and you can just sort of have your say?
Oh yeah, I definitely do. And don't get me wrong, Tennessee Williams is actually my favorite playwright, being from the South. So I always use him as an example because, you know, there's an obvious joy and reward in doing Tennessee Williams. Most of those plays, they're classic American plays, and they're near perfect plays structurally, in terms of character development, in terms of story, and they work.
What do you mean structurally?
Just in terms of their, like, dramatic action, like in
like
terms
the
of
arc that it takes.
Yeah, exactly. The setup, the climax, the payoff. They're near perfect plays, right? That's why they've been done for so long. Just like Shakespeare, you know. So there, and there's this extreme reward in doing a play that you know works, right? Because you're not, when you're doing a new play, or sorry, let's just say when you're doing any play, you have enough to worry about, right? You have the actors' performances, the technical elements, your direction, the audience response. And, you know, in terms of technical elements, you've got scenic, light, sound, costumes. So you've got enough plates to spin. And when you do a new play, you add in this huge other plate, which is, does the script work? And that's what's so great about directing a classic is you don't even have to have that worry. You know the script works.
Right.
So you just have to make everything work else work in accordance
sort of
with
like
the script.
Technically, like the lights and the
sound and the actors. And but then on the flip side of that, if you don't do a good job, you can't blame it on the script. Like, you know, that's on, you know, if you can't make the Glass Menagerie or who we just did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at B Street. If you can't make those amazing classics work, then it's like that's on your production because those plays have been done for decades.
So that can sort of have its own.
So it has its own challenges. And it also,
yeah.
Kind of the benefit and the challenge of doing a new play, is that the audience has no expectation. That's both the benefit because most people have seen movies or productions of The Glass Menagerie or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or, Glengarry Glen Ross, but they've never seen a production of your new play that's never been done. So one, they might not be excited about it because they don't know, but they also will be more receptive to whatever they do see.
So, you know, just thinking in my mind's eye here, I don't really know anything about this, but that's kind of the fun of running the podcast.
Yeah,
is you get to pick
get
people's
to learn.
Brain. If you are doing like a Tennessee Williams play, you could conceivably look up other productions of that same play and sort
right.
of have an idea in your mind's eye of like, oh,
this was this Broadway production
or whatever.
Yeah, this
is what the shot is supposed to look like, or this right. is what it's... supposed to look like on stage.
Right.
Whereas with a completely new production, you're sort of creating that in your mind's eye. Is that right?
Yeah, you're envisioning something that nobody's ever envisioned before. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, other than the playwright when they were sitting alone writing it. But, you know, playwrights, that's why playwrights need actors and directors is because other than that, playwriting is a solitary art form. You know, so you write it by yourself and then somebody has to do it.
Right. So as you create the set and the playwrights right there, are they ever like, you know, I didn't imagine the furniture being looking like that.
Oh, yeah. Some people do say that.
I thought it would look a little bit more dreary.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Right?
And playwrights, you know.
How much latitude do you give them?
It does depend on one, who it is, two, when they're saying that.
Are you ever like, well, it doesn't say dreary in here?
Yeah, I typically always try, if somebody says that, like if somebody says, oh, I envisioned the set looking more dreary, which I could totally, hopefully they would be saying that in initial design meetings so that the designer can incorporate that feedback or that I can incorporate that feedback in an appropriate way.
Is that part of the, like the storyboarding or design? It's kind of
yeah.
like this is like a dark and ominous here. We're sort of like uplifting.
Yeah. And you
here
would see
redemptive.
Exactly. You would see drawings with possibly lighting looks. You would see paint treatments, renderings of how the set would look. This is the end of the show. This is the beginning of the show. This is this scene in the house. This is this scene outside. Whatever the play is. Hopefully the playwright would say that in these initial discussions so that everybody could kind of have their process, right? Filter that in and then take that note and come up with their own way of interpreting that note.
Cool. Look how much I'm learning about putting on plays.
yeah, right? Probably more than you ever want to know.
No, this is so cool. Like, I think it's so... Like when I was younger, I used to just watch a lot of like How It's Made.
Yeah, exactly. This is like totally How It's Made. But let's say you're in rehearsal. You've already decided on what the set's going to be and you're working with it. And the playwright says, oh, I thought the it would be more, this furniture would be more drab, or that the paint treatment would be peeling or whatever. I try to always ask a question. It's like, well, why did you think that? What do you think that contributes to the story? You know? And if they can say it,
like if they can articulate like a meaningful response to
that. If they can say, oh, well, it shows that this character hasn't left their house in 5 years or whatever. The fact that the home looks like this. And that's very important to the story because we're following the journey of this character as a recluse. Okay, but whatever the story is. But if they just say, well, oh, that's just how I imagined it when I was writing it. It's like, well, you know, let's actually discuss if that was just something that you imagined or if that's something that's really vital to the telling of this story.
Okay. As a, do you get to, as a director, do you get to pick what plays you're going to wind up directing? Are you ever stuck directing a play you would really rather not? Just because you weren't jazzed on it? Or?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I learned at B Street and have learned since is that, you know, theater is my passion. It's my love. I'm so enthused about it, but it's also a job, you know? and sometimes at jobs, you do things that you don't want to do and you find a way to make yourself feel excited about it. And so at B Street, I'm on staff. So if our artistic director says you're directing this, that's my job. You know, it's like when your boss puts an assignment on your desk.
Right.
And part of my job as an artist and an employee is to say, how can I connect to this piece if I don't already feel connected? And you know, I'm also at a place in my career where when I do get freelance offers from other places, I don't want to turn them down because I want to continue to make connections and get experience. And so those are often times too when I just don't even know the play. If it's a new play, I've never even heard of it, and I have to read it and get acquainted with it and find what excites me about it.
Does that process ever surprise you when you're like, man, you know what? I wasn't feeling this sort of character development arc, and now that I've seen it put together, wow, I kind of... Like that snuck up on me. I'm actually a lot more endeared to this the storyline than I thought I would be.
All the time. I was thinking this the other day. All the time that happens. Partially because theater is brought to life by the work of so many people. You know, so what the playwright can write and what I can envision on a first read or a second read or a 10th read is pretty much nothing in comparison to what can be brought to life when you add actors, designers, a theater space, an audience. You know, it's such a collective sort of mind art form. But also, theater is one of those things that it's like, almost every time I do it, I'm like, this isn't going to work. You know, it's just, you always have the feeling of like, how's this going to come together? Is this story going to work? Even if it's a play that's been done before, there's always that slight bit of doubt that all the elements aren't going to do that. At the right time.
Is it fair to say that there's a, an artistic, almost like boilerplate process for like storyboarding, set design, stuff like that, that's sort of like, you know, portable from play to play, like this overall like process management, and then on top of that, each play has its own unique challenges?
Oh, yeah, I would say definitely. You know, there's a pretty standard process at most theaters, in terms of design and what we would call pre-production process. And obviously that is pretty standard, but varies depending on the theater's budget and the theater's leadership and what they view as a priority. But then once you get into rehearsal, it's you and the actors in the play and the playwright if they're there. And that's when you discover what the challenges and great successes of the piece are. And you really don't learn until then. And if you've made a casting mistake.
That was the next question I was going to ask. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw on Facebook that you were in New York City holding auditions for a play that you're currently producing.
Yeah.
I wondered about this. I'm always just curious about how things work. Is there not like a specific cast that's married to the theater, or are they kind of brought in and contracted play to play?
So actually, yes. We have a company of a core company of 10 local actors that we use in a minimum of 3 shows per year each. And then kind of a wider company that includes about 15 other actors that are in LA, New York, that work regionally. And we use those people in probably 1 to 2 shows a year. Go ahead.
Sorry. Do you sort of bring in the folks for the specific shows when you're looking for a specific type of character that's not like within the range of the character of the actors that you have at your disposal, or maybe they just look different or something like that? Or
yeah, of course, it's all about what in theater we call type, you know, which is age, gender, race. So I when I teach directing, I divide type up into 2 things, like the physical things, which you can't change, which are the things that I just named, and then the personality things that just kind of emanate, you know, from you, that are, you know, this person's athletic, they're a strong presence, they're feminine, they're ethereal, they're a leading man. You know, these things that it's like, I don't quite know why, that just is who they are.
Right. Do actors have a range of like emotions that they can play in? Maybe there's some things that are almost like singers with notes that they can sing, like sort of different vibes that they could.
And most actors think they can play everything and they can't.
Yeah. See, I'd like to think like for a guy like myself, I could probably play anything from like impetuous young man to like broken down old soul.
Yeah,
you know,
see,
something, you know, kind of in between there, but
and I that would never be
able to, yeah, I would never be able to do something like a Jim Carrey over the top kind of like, you know, like the
broad comedic guy.
The broad comedic, and also he's like it's like physical comedy with him too, right? Like he's like, he's just being a goofball. I could never do that, you know?
Yeah, so there's all those things. And so basically what we do is we take our company, we cast them out, and then in the roles that are still available, we cast in the Bay Area, New York, and LA. And when you cast, sometimes you hold an open casting session and you take appointments and you see people for your whole season. What I was doing in New York is I was actually casting on appointment for 5 roles. So you're seeing people for specific roles, and we hired a casting director who's based out of New York, and she basically does everything for us. She gets the space, she coordinates the sides, which are the audition material that the actors use. She gets the accompanists for those who are going to be singing. She books their appointments, she books their callbacks, and we basically, it's awesome. We just show up and say who you like, which is, when we do our auditions here, of course, we're producing the whole thing. Yeah. But, so it was quite nice to just be there, and she also, you know, we hired her to work for us, so she wants to be hired again, so she's going to make sure she brings in the best talent possible, you know? So it's much different than when you're just holding an open audition and you're getting whoever shows up at your door.
Does that process ever ruffle feathers? If you have an actor that thinks, like, oh, I'm hoping for this role,
and then
you just don't see that in them for whatever reason, and then you have to go to New York to find that role, and then the person from New York maybe has no idea that they're coming in to, like a jealous, you know, sort of a jealous
somebody who's already in the company. Yeah,
wanted that role.
I think
it's not like you're shooting the movie once and then you kind of all go your separate ways. You're all like living together and like in the same space, right? In the same physical space, working together in the same space.
Right.
Does that?
It does happen. Fortunately, it does, because like I said, a lot of actors, I won't say all, a lot of actors think that they can play anything, and also actors age and change, right? So the things that they could play 10 years ago, they can't necessarily play anymore, even though they may want to. That's just kind of the nature of the business. So fortunately, while there might be hard feelings at first, we take such good care of our company. You know, we make sure that they get work and that they have their equity weeks for their health insurance and their pension. And so it's the good news is it's not like they're like, oh, I'm not going to get work, because they know we're going to put them either in another role that's better for them, or in an upcoming show. And then, you know, actors deal with rejection their entire careers. So if you're going to be a pro, you're going to have to deal with somebody getting the role over you. Mm-hmm. And so the professionals, they feel it and then they let it go.
Yeah.
You know,
going back to that, that casting process, right? I'm just so tremendously curious about this. So if you have like a script that you're kind of imbuing with sort of what you want to see right. emanating from that actor, right? Like I would like to see like a previously tender heart with now imbued with a sense of forlornness, right? And so you're looking for that sense of like forlornness emanating from the actor, right?
Right. And like we were just auditioning. That's a great example. We were just auditioning for like a CEO type of role. But he's got to be ambitious, but not slick, you know? Okay. And so finding that person who embodies that sort of drive that he has, but doesn't play it like super sleazy. Slick and sleazy. Yeah. And that's, you know, and making sure that you really get that right person. Because that one, I don't want to say mistake, but mistake can change the story. And make the play not have the journey it's supposed to have.
So are you like paying really close attention to like their facial expressions, or is it more of like a I know it when I see it type of deal?
It's both. You know, I would say I can tell within less than 30 seconds. If I'm going to call them back. Then at the callback, it's a little bit different. You're paying much closer attention. In the first audition, you're looking at, are they the right type? Are they relaxed? Are they making interesting choices? You know, you're looking at kind of the basic package. And then in the callback is kind of where you really put them through some steps to see if they, can they take direction? Can they, this character in one scene needs to be very high status. And then at the end of the play is broken down. Can they do that? You know, because that's how journeys of characters work, and you want to get somebody who can do that.
The whole range.
Yeah. So I would say the first audition, more of a general look. The callback, much more specific at their specific choices, their ability to take direction when we give them an adjustment, and their ability to understand exactly what their character's trying to do to the other person on stage.
Got it. So what is a casting mistake?
What is a casting mistake? A casting mistake is most often, is I would say, not the actor's fault. It's the producer and the director's fault for not really doing their due diligence. So, I mean, there's obviously various types of casting mistakes. There's casting somebody who's not a good actor. So that's kind of the worst one, right?
Ouch.
Followed closely by casting somebody who's very difficult to work with. I would say that's only second, because if they're difficult but they're a great actor, you can typically get through the 3-week rehearsal process. And the third being casting somebody who's just not the right type, which sometimes if they're a great actor, you can make work. And then the fourth being that, you know, sometimes you cast a great actor who has pretty good instincts in an audition, but then they don't know how to take direction and adjustments. So you're not really going to get the performance that you need. So those are, there's obviously nuances in between all of those, but those are kind of the basic, like, these are the mistakes we made. But obviously the worst is that, you know, we're in Sacramento, so we cast off of video auditions fairly frequently when we can't be in New York or LA. And you have to remember, with the video audition, somebody could do 10 takes and send you the best one.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you might not actually be getting a great actor who can deliver, you know? You know,
I talk about this. I talk about this with my friends who sort of related similar, I think similar thing. I talk about this sort of phenomena with my buddies who are still online dating.
Right.
And I tell them, you know, you have to remember, they're going to look worse than their worst picture.
That's so true.
Because you're only going to curate pictures where you look, you know, you think well, right? So take the worst one and then imagine that they worse look than that. Okay, still want to go on a date? Great.
Yeah, but it's exactly. Yeah, because casting is like a brief marriage, you know? And it's hard. It is exactly. That's a great example, because it's, at the end of the day, no matter how much you do, again, it's always a crapshoot. You can check references and you can direct them in the audition and give them notes. And then you just don't know, once you get them into rehearsal and are trying to get that performance that you need to tell the story if they're going to be able to deliver.
Yeah. Can we talk about going back to giving these adjustments a little bit?
Yeah.
I'm imagining you sort of in the director's chair or the table or whatever it is that you sit at, and you're watching these actors go through, whatever type of scene, right?
Right.
And say, cut. I need you to look more brokenhearted. I'm not, how does that work? Was like, well, this is as brokenhearted as I get. Well, I need you to look more brokenhearted. How does that coaching process work?
Yeah. So I think it's different for all directors, first of all. And I think part of the challenge of being a director is that every actor that you work with has different training, or possibly no training, or different vocabulary than you, different things that mean something to them. So I'd say first and foremost, I always try to communicate in the form of action. In theater, we talk about characters have an objective. Hamlet's objective is to avenge his father.
Got it.
And that it's his super objective throughout the whole play. And then in each scene, he has an objective that furthers that, to expose Claudius, to corner Polonius, all those sort of things that they're trying to do in order to do that big thing. Okay. So I try to speak to them in terms of actions, like, okay, here, try to intimidate them. Here, try to flatter them to get you to tell them the truth, or to get them to tell you the truth. So using action, because acting is all about what they're doing to the other person. If you want somebody to be brokenhearted, are they trying to guilt the other person? Mm. Are they trying to confess their feelings? Are they grasping at straws to find a reason to live? So trying to think of it in terms of action. And then if an actor doesn't relate to that, often you go to personal experience. You say, what's the thing that means the most to you in your life? Okay, think about how you would feel if you lost that.
Okay.
And what would you do? What would you do if you lost that?
Okay.
An experienced actor will typically be able to take a note of like, I was intimidating them there, but you really want me to flatter them or to condescend to them. Oh, I can easily do that. They know they kind of have that arsenal of like different things, actions that they can do. But less experienced actors, they might need a little bit more relating to their personal experience to get them there.
Very cool. Very cool. So what plays are you overseeing now?
Well, I just opened Kings of America at Sacramento Theater Company. And that was a new play by a playwright who's on staff at B Street, Sean Patrick Nill. And we've gotten some great reviews, so we're really excited about that. And that runs through December 10th or so. And then I'm writing and directing the first family series at the Sophia, home of the B Street, which will open in February 24th of next year. It's an original musical about the life of Gandhi, told through the eyes of a high school student who is Indian American, who's being bullied due to his race and is responding through getting into fights, and is exposed to the life of Mahatma Gandhi, and ultimately goes on that journey of passive resistance and nonviolence. So I'm writing and directing that, and that's taking most of my artistic time right now.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about Kings of America?
I can, yeah. So Kings of America, like I said, it's a new play, and it's a story about, I call it a story about memory, and how we remember and what we remember. The storyline is that Noah Garrison, he's a high school student, and a self-proclaimed history buff, is going through basically a family crisis. And he gets sent to a therapist because he was a great student, but now he's sleeping in class, his grades are slipping. And he confesses to his therapist that he's been having these thematic dreams where he's interacting with presidents. So through these dreams, we see a cast of three actors play 12 presidents. And through these dreams, he kind of, he comes, it's a coming of age story. He comes to know himself and understand how he's going to cope with this very adult thing that he's going through. And then also kind of parallel to that, you know, understands how we remember as Americans, and that a lot of times we label presidents as good or bad, but that often it's much more nuanced than that, and much more human than that. And that's the story. It's really, it's a beautiful play, and it's so, it's timely. And I think that it's political in an unpolitical way, you know, because it really makes you think about, and which this is probably a very touchy subject right now, but politicians as humans who have a pretty impossible...
Yeah, they are still human.
Yeah, and they have a pretty impossible task.
Let me tell you, having worked for, you know, a number of elected officials now, they are deeply, deeply human. And yeah. We're kind of in this environment, unfortunately, I think, where they kind of feel like almost like not allowed to be human, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they kind of always have to be... like proper and never want to misspeak and yeah. You know, but almost to the point where there's no substance left to the personality that's left after you scrub away all the imperfections.
Yeah,
you know?
And there's got to be permission to be imperfect,
right?
And that's what this play is largely about. And then also looking at those presidents that we revere, idolize, that they were also imperfect, you know, and the ones that we thought were awful maybe also did some good things. So it's a great story. And I think it's one that it will touch people right now.
Yeah. Memory is a funny thing like that.
It is.
In my professional endeavors, I've had people come and sort of lobby me as a staff member, on sort of like things that have to do with our collective recollection of yes. historical events, right? And so you'll have folks from one side of the historical event come and talk to you, you know, because the state's considering a proclamation or something like that. And I'll be like, well, this is really what happened. And they're like earnest and tenderhearted and forthcoming. And they like in their,
you they know, believe it.
Yeah. In their community of memory, they believe that. And then the other side comes and they're like, no, this is what happened. And it's like totally like, I was like, fuck, is this even the same story?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's so elusive.
They both totally believe it.
Yeah.
Like, they both totally believe it.
And it's not like you can condemn one of lying, you know, say, oh, you're lying. Because you just don't know. It doesn't work like that.
No,
you know?
It doesn't work like that. It's funny how, you know, not to stay too long on the subject, but I do think it's interesting how, in our collective memory right now, George Bush.
W
is kind of a teddy bear now.
Right. That's
he's like painting, right? Yeah. And he's like throwing out the first pitch at a ballpark where it's like, you know, and everyone's like, oh, isn't it? And then there was this
George.
There was this meme. There was this meme where he like couldn't get his
poncho on at the inauguration. You're like, aw.
Yeah, and that's kind of what happened. That's kind of how it started, right? And now there's out there in the ether, there's this sort of collective sense that this old president's just a teddy bear. You know, and it's like, well, you know, he's been the same guy all along.
Even though he was pretty hated when he was in office.
Yeah, just, you know. Just
which was not that long ago.
Just 10 years ago, right? Yeah. Those were the original Not My President stickers.
Yeah. And you know...
And now he's a teddy bear.
Painting and smiling and, you know, on Ellen and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like, you know, he is still the same person. And that applies to both sides of it.
Yeah.
He still did the things that he did. And he was still this teddy bear of a person when he was doing those things, mm-hmm. you know?
Can you kind of preview the opening of the Beastry for us and sort of, can you explain the two spaces, how... the new one's better than the old. I'm ashamed to say I've not been.
It's okay. We'll got to get you in.
Yeah. I'd love to come. But.
So essentially the current B Street Theater is a little shack by the railroad tracks, over on B and 27th in the back of Midtown over by like the dog park and the skate park. And it's two theater spaces, both converted. They weren't designed to be theaters. One that's 180 seat thrust space, which means audience on three sides. And then the other that's about a 110 seat thrust space, but a little bit more shallow. So the main stage is kind of almost like it juts out into the audience, almost like a catwalk.
Oh, cool.
And so anyway, that's our current space. So the Sophia, which will be the new facility, which is home of the B Street, opening in February, is in a prime location. It's on Capitol and 27th. So right near Biba's, Paragary's, Sutter Hospital. It's in the Sutter District, right by Sutter's Fort. And it's a $30 million ground up project.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, the most important thing being it's designed to be a theater and performing arts facility. You know, it's been 20 years in the making. It's a two theater complex, one which is a 250 seat thrust space, which will be the home to our main stage, our adult programming, and then a 365 seat proscenium space, which is just audience on one side, kind of like and the stage is a Broadway size stage, with still a really intimate house, audience configuration, and that will be home to our family series programming during the afternoons and the mornings for field trips. And then at night, it's going to be home to music, dance, local arts groups, lectures, stand-up comedy, basically almost like a roadhouse for events in the community. Then in addition to the two theater spaces, we have a full service bar, a restaurant attached to the theater, and then three rehearsal halls, above the theaters, one of which will be a 75 seat, small theater for more experimental work, workshops for developing new plays, slam poetry, open mics, that sort of thing. So what we've been telling people is don't think about this like an expansion, a slight expansion of the current B Street. This is an entirely new business, basically. Mm-hmm. It's going from being a theater to a performing arts center. Wow. That's run by the staff of a theater. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's, you know, and so it's named the Sophia after Sophia Sakopoulos and the Sakopoulos family. So that Sophia is the name of the complex, but what is important and still part of our brand is that it's
B Street Theater.
It's at home of the B Street. Yeah. And because we know that the B Street and our mission of doing quality theater for children and adults is what people have given to and subscribed to and believed in for all these years. And we want to make sure that they know we're still B Street.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about quality theater for children, and I kind of just thought about this, but you know, we're spending increasing amounts of time on our screen.
Right.
Right.
So much screen time.
Yeah. And like theater is like really old timey, right? It's beautiful.
It does feel antiquated.
It's beautiful,
yeah.
Right. I actually think that's really what makes it so powerful. But to what extent do you think that like sort of like this technological arc that we're embarking on, how does theater cope with that? Like how does the infrastructure of theater stay relevant in school districts and the arts, as you know, like you take a kid to a play nowadays and it's like, wow, what's this, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's the reason that schools should continue to take kids to plays. And you know, we get that question asked, not necessarily the screen time question, but the question of like, well, we only have a certain amount of field trip dollars. Why should we take our kids to the play,
right,
and not to the train museum or whatever? and our calling card and our argument towards that is that there is no substitute for live storytelling that takes place in the room, breathing the same air, not only as your fellow audience members, but also the people performing of the story. And you know, we say that obviously theater can be entertainment, and it can be educational, and it can also encourage empathy for people of different situations, different backgrounds, different races, nationalities, socioeconomic classes. It really exposes kids and encourages, because they are sharing that experience with the actors, and it really encourages empathy with different types of characters and different types of stories. Mm-hmm. And that's not something, you know, not to say there's not value in going to the train museum or taking the students to see a film or whatever the case may be, but there's no substitute for that exchange. And for what, you know, we can see anything on our screens, right? We have everything at our fingertips, but still what can be magically done in front of you is almost, it's, I think, more mesmerizing than something you can just pull up on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then afterwards you meet the kids can meet the actors and talk with them and ask them questions. And it's like about how, what does it mean to be, have a career as an actor? How long do you guys rehearse this? How do you come up with all these things? You know, they get to really learn about the process too.
Right. Right. And sort of see how the actor sort of slipped into a different person for a second. Right.
Right. And they, a big thing for us is that we want theater to educate about topics. Whether those are social topics, bullying, what have you, or you know, historical, more general educational topics. But we want kids to fall in love with theater. And we want kids to see that actors, that you can have a career in this, that actors are real people, and that this is a job that they're doing, and that they, this is something you can do too. This can be you if you want it to be, and that's your dream. And that is something that live theater can really provide for kids.
Yeah. I personally think it's so important to, I think it's going to become increasingly important to expose children, to the depth of, character, and to the complexity of character that theater allows, as opposed to, you know, you take a kid to see a Michael Bay movie, or you take a kid to see like a Fast and Furious movie, and the characters are pretty shallow, right? Like, this is a guy that likes to ride his motorcycle fast and he's going to shoot guns all the way.
Yeah, this is the villain and this is the good guy or whatever.
Yeah. And I'm concerned that if we become exposed to that in our, to only that sort of character trait in entertainment, that the people who are absorbing this will develop similarly shallow characters if that's all they're absorbing, right? Where I think that it's important to expose children to, you know, to just characters and character and the complexity of people, you know, no CGI, none of that stuff. Just the beauty of humanity in it.
The beauty of humanity in gray area. And, you know, I mean, you take one of those classic stories ever told, who is right and who's wrong in Romeo and Juliet, you know,
nobody.
It's a tragedy. And that's why it is a tragedy. And that's why those families have to learn from that, is because nobody's in the right or wrong there. And that's the complexity that theater can really capture, is these sort of social conflicts that don't have a good guy and a bad guy, that really have people actually fighting for what they think is right. And that's, those different objectives create conflict. And that's, you know, it's, that's why I think kids need to be exposed to theater, is because they can engage with those characters and really create empathy for different situations that they might not have been or ever be exposed to in their real lives.
When you were a child yourself, as I was reading about you, I read this and it said, like, you knew right from the start you wanted to be a director.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that like? You acted a little bit.
I did.
Well, I guess you had to act through college, right? Because of your education.
And I did act in middle school and high school, and I kept acting. So I think there's a strange thing about, like, realizing that you want to be a director. A lot of people act or produce or a stage manager who kind of manages the production. They might do that for 10, 15, 20 years and then become a director. I knew very early on when I was acting that I was great actors are really, they have a perception of the whole play. They do, because they have to, but they're only pursuing what their character wants. And that's why they're a great actor, is because it's just fearlessly going after what that character needs. And I was not doing that. I was focusing on all the other production elements and the production as a whole. And when you're acting, that doesn't make you a great actor. It kind of makes you distracted. And I was like, I really need to be on the other side of this. I honestly can't tell you how I had that realization as a child, basically, but I just knew, I was like, I would rather be doing what my teachers are doing than what I'm doing right now. And not that I didn't love acting, and I love actors, and I so look up to great actors, because I think to immerse yourself in a character and just really go after something is such a talent. But, you know, I just think I have a different talent. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Do you have any advice for young actors or aspiring directors coming up, like in college?
I do. You know, so I would say a few things. Just do perform or direct as much as you can, because you will only get more relaxed and more confident and more, you know, knowledge and experience through doing. Mm-hmm. You know, school is great. Assisting is great. Being an understudy is great, and you should do those things, but you also have to find ways to just direct or act as much as you possibly can. And then my other advice, and you know, some people don't necessarily believe this, I think when you're starting out, as long as your integrity or your beliefs aren't compromised, say yes until you have to say no. You know, go to that audition even though you know you have to go to work that afternoon. You know, direct that stage reading that a playwright asked you to direct, even though you know that you have no time. Like, do those things, because, you know, that audition might be the audition. That stage reading that you direct for that nobody playwright might end up being the hottest playwright in the country in 5 years, and then they want you to direct their play. You just don't know. But if you don't say yes when you're starting out, you can't have those experiences, and it's also important to have bad experiences, you know? So, like, if you say yes to a production, acting in a production at some regional theater, and you don't have a great time, and it's not fun, it's like, you still needed to have that. You know, you still need to have these things. It can't just be this easy sort of...
That makes you better.
Yeah, it makes you better, and it makes you realize, you know, this is a hard career, like any career, but this is a very hard career, and like I said, there's no set path. And so you have to figure out what's important to you. You know, if building a home in a certain area and having a community is important to you, maybe you don't want to be in New York hustling and pounding the pavement every day. But if being in a metropolitan city where you can go see a different show every night is important to you, maybe you do want to be in New York or LA. So it's all about determining your priorities. And you can't do that unless you just say yes to things, mm-hmm. You know, and put yourself out there. And so those are really my big advice. And then just, you know, take care of yourself, and then just don't let the industry get to you, because that's...
What does that mean, don't let the industry? Just like all the rejection.
Just don't let the rejection, you know, this is what I always say is...
Are people in the industry, can they be kind of nasty to each other?
Yeah, they can. And because why I also think comparison is a big thing. And so I try to say, I mean, I'm a young artist, and so I say it to myself, just... Don't compare yourself to other actors or directors your age, or other actors or directors 10 years older than you. Think, oh, I got to be there, I got to do this. Just be where you are, and don't let the pressure and the comparative nature of the industry get to you. You know, this is an industry where everybody is always promoting, always updating their website, always promoting their productions, because they have to be, because nobody else is going to be promoting you. So what you're seeing on people's Facebooks and websites and all this stuff doesn't mean they're happy. It doesn't mean that their career is that much better than yours. It's just, don't let all that stuff get... Don't let all that noise and that rejection and that comparison get to you. Just got to, like, do your thing. And,
well, you know, they say comparison is the thief of joy.
It is. It's so true. And it applies to everybody in every career and relationship and life situation, but it's so easy to do in this business, because, you know, reviews are in front of you, and oh, I have this friend who's now on this TV show and they're famous, and
right,
well,
you're tracking cohorts, right? Because yeah, you're like the people that you graduated with, your internship company, and now, yeah, maybe one of them is on, you yeah, know, is in the movies, and you're still, yeah, kind of hitting, yeah, and
exactly,
that can
and
be really,
and the community is so really small hard. Everybody knows everybody, so it's like, you know, everybody who's in the industry is going to know several people on Broadway and several people on TV and several people who are, you know, successful, you know, models or whatever, you know, the case may be. So it's like, you really just have to do what you need to do and what makes you the most fulfilled as an artist and a person.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. That's basically the best advice I can give. And I think the hardest thing is just knowing what that is.
Sure.
You know,
sure. I like that. Well, we're, coming up at right over an hour here. That flew by.
Yes. Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Yeah. Last question for you. Since you've been here 5 years.
Yes.
What are your sort of like favorite places to hang out in, you know, in town? What are
Oh, so, okay. Well, I do love to eat. I love all the food in Midtown. Bistree has a partnership with Casbah Bar and Lounge, and I love Casbah. I love the atmosphere. I love the owners, Debbie and Tanya.
Where is that?
It's on 21st and J, right by Top of the World, which I also really like. But it's Casbah's very like an international hub. You go there and you hear people speaking different languages.
Oh, cool.
So that's a really cool place in terms of like, you know, I live in Midtown, so, you know, we hit up the classic places. We love for Mexican Tres Hermanas. We love, you know, to take the dog to Beer Garden, and hang out outside McKinley Park.
Yeah.
And let's see, where else? You know, there's just, you know, and love to go down to the Capitol and walk around in the Rose Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And just love to like go to Temple or wherever and sit outside and have a cup of coffee and
The penny floor at Temple is so gorgeous.
It's awesome. And I also love Tupelo as well over in East Sac. So those are, I love to go to those places, just, you know, hang out, can take the dog, sit outside. You know, that's what I love about Sacramento is it's still calm enough. It's a city, but it's still calm enough to where I feel like there's that neighborhood, very kind of quaint and personal feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually really enjoy that.
Me too. I love that.
Yeah. I was just at La Benedita.
Ooh, I've not been there. Is it good?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. It's across the street from Arthur Henry's.
Oh.
And we were going to go to Arthur Henry's, and then we kind of, I don't know, we just stopped at La Benedita instead. Their margaritas are great. They're,
love that.
Yeah, I had the vampire tacos. It's al pastor, cheese.
Sounds so good.
Like a spicier type of sauce is so good. So,
oh, I love Mexican food. I love.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're in Broadway, and if you're in Broadway, around Oak Park, go to La Benedita. You can tell them Jabron sent you, but they won't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I'll tell them. Jabron sent me.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Of course. Thank you so much, Jabron. And thank you for having me and for thinking of us at B Street and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, quickly. Are you all selling tickets for 2018?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I should have said that. So we are selling tickets currently, getting ready to open on Sunday is our last show at the current space. It's called A Moving Day, appropriately.
Oh, fun.
And it's a world premiere holiday show. And so that opens Sunday and runs until December 24th. We're selling tickets for that. And then our whole 2018 season in the new space is open to buy a subscription.
Okay.
And single tickets for One Man, Two Governors, which is the first show in the new space, will go on sale December 1st.
Okay. And so, what's the website?
www.bstreettheater.org or 916-443-5300 if you just want an old-fashioned call the box office.
Got it. We'll flash them on the screen. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Jabron.